Well, here's a great all-American figure. I mean, in that great sort of scrappy populist tradition. He grows up in a very prominent Republican family in Philadelphia, the Butler family. His father is a powerful Republican congressman, very patriotic family. He runs off to war at 16. He says, you know what, I'm tired of school, and I'm going to sign up. He runs off to the Spanish-American War. He then goes on to China to fight in the Boxer Rebellion, where he's wounded twice. He's 18. He's a young lieutenant in the Marines there. And then he goes on to fight in just about every, as they were called at the time, the Banana Wars in Central America and the Caribbean. So he in Nicaragua and Panama and Haiti. He's in charge of the U.S. occupation of Haiti, which lasts for almost 20 years, from 1915 into the 30s. And he wins the Congressional Medal of Honor twice. He's an incredibly physically brave soldier, puts himself in harm's way all the time. He's beloved by his soldiers. He's always the first one into the fray. But he's then sent to France in World War I. He's looking forward to what he calls the first big war of his career. And yet he's put in charge of the camps there where the young doughboys, the soldiers, are flowing into Europe. And then after they go through the traumas of the Western Front, they come back home. And he sees the kind of industrial-level carnage of that war, a war which was, for all practical purposes, senseless. Even today, historians can't make really any sense of the war, what the world was fighting about.
Right.
And he sees people damaged, not only their bodies, but their psyches in ways that he's never seen before in war. And then when he comes home, he sees how these veterans, these young men who were once the apple of their family's eye, are thrown away like garbage in veterans' hospitals, which were atrocious, and particularly atrocious in those days. And it really radicalizes him. He has an awakening. It's like an epiphany for him. And he says, you know what? I was fighting for and dying, my boys, for Wall Street and for Standard and for the oil companies and for the weapons manufacturers, not for Uncle Sam. And he becomes so appalled by that realization that he devotes the rest of his life to campaigning for veterans' rights and for peace. He's not a pacifist. He sees that there's danger in the world, and America has to be prepared for that. In fact, at one point, he blows the whistle on Mussolini, who's the rising, of course, fascist leader in Italy of the day, and beloved, by the way, by many in the American media because they thought he was modernizing Italy and so on. You know, he made the trains run on time and all that. And Time magazine puts him on the cover, Henry Luce, the Time Life Baron, you know, who was kind of a fascist sympathizer. In fact, it was very strange and volatile times then, and a lot of people in the elite circles in America were fascist sympathizers. But Spandley Butler gives a speech saying, no, Mussolini's a mad dog. In fact, he ran over a little girl in Italy and never looked back. And he was with an American newspaper man at the time who told Butler the story. Well, when Butler says this, it creates an international incident. President Hoover actually puts him under house arrest on the Marine base in Quantico. So Butler spoke his mind. He was a brave guy, but his greatest act of heroism was not on the battlefields. It was back home. After he leaves the Marines, he's approached in 1933. He switches parties to campaign for Franklin Roosevelt for president in 1932 because he's so angry at Herbert Hoover for unleashing Douglas MacArthur and the army on the veterans who've marched on Washington for benefits, the famous Bonus Army March.
Right.
And he's so angry at Hoover for doing this that he switches parties. He campaigns for FDR. He thinks FDR is the only one who can save the country. And in 1933, he's home. He's out of the Marines. He's retired now. Two guys roll up his driveway in a nice car. They come out. They identify themselves as members of the American Legion. Turns out they're emissaries from Wall Street. They're connected to a very powerful Wall Street guy named Grayson Murphy, who was the founder of the American Legion also. And they began to tell him about a plot that they're involved in to basically intimidate President Roosevelt into stepping down. And they want Smedley Butler to lead an army of a 500,000 veterans to march on Washington, except this time they're going to be armed. Through the show of force, convince President Roosevelt that, you know, for the good of the nation and for his own good, he should step down and hand over power to a group of bankers and military people. Well, Smedley Butler, you know, hears them out. He meets
them several
times.
Wait, let me back up. I'm going to back up. Sure. Why, if they knew of his change of heart, why would they approach him with this information?
Well, because they knew what was the most important thing to Smedley Butler was the veterans. And Smedley Butler by then thought that Roosevelt was selling out the veterans because he hadn't backed the bonus bill. And, of course, it would be years until Roosevelt signed the famous GI Bill of Rights. And, of course, you know, as a result, the soldiers coming back from World War II didn't have to march on Washington for their benefits like the World War I veterans. But at that point, you know, FDR was waffling on benefits for the veterans, and Smedley Butler began to think that he'd been sold out on that.
That would put him in the same. I'm just trying to give some context. Then sure. He might be like today. He might be like some of the progressives who are maddest at President Obama.
Absolutely.
For going back on some of his promises, and so
very
they're
similar.
Like, hey, this was the guy you said you were going to be different, and you're exactly the same as the administration that came before.
That's right. And so they were saying, now look, if and a true patriot as you are, who cares about the soldiers, needs to do something about this. So they were appealing to him on patriotic grounds. They also said, look, from their point of view, FDR was ruining the economy. He was taking the country off the gold standard. He was pursuing inflationary policies in order to pay for his social programs and to put people back to work that were diluting the wealth of these Wall Street bankers. But they also put it to Butler that this was harming the country's economy as well. Well, Butler said to them, look, I don't know about any of that economic stuff, but I care about the soldiers. So they thought they might have a way to get to him. They wanted Douglas MacArthur. They preferred Douglas MacArthur. They thought they trusted him more to carry out this plot because his politics, and he was quite conservative, were more in line with their own. But they knew that after what MacArthur did to the Bonus Army marchers, tear gassing them and driving them out of Washington in 1932 with bayonets, that they would never follow him. They'd rather hang him. So
right.
They thought Butler was their way to go. He was enormously popular with the rank-and-file soldiers. And so he, as I say, he kind of leads them on. He meets with them several times, these emissaries from Wall Street. But in the end, he goes before Congress, just like an old Frank Capra movie, like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or Mr. Deeds, the great movie with Gary Cooper. And he exposes the plot. And it's it's a turning point in American democracy. He says, wake up, America. These people have enormous power. He names names. J.P. Morgan was the central financial power at the heart of this plot, which was the Goldman Sachs of its day, very powerful. And, of course, J.P. Morgan's still the name on Wall Street. DuPont family, he names. The DuPont family were fascist sympathizers. They were doing business with the Germans. They hated the Morgans and the DuPonts hated FDR. Old J.P. Morgan himself hated FDR so much that he had his servants clip out photos of Roosevelt from the morning newspaper before he read it because his blood pressure would shoot up so high just to see a picture of Roosevelt. They thought of Franklin Roosevelt as a class traitor. They thought of him as someone who had turned against his own interests, his own people, and was selling out the country to unions, to the Jews, they thought. They were anti-Semitic, many of these people. And so, today we think, we've never seen the kind of passions that swirled around, the poisonous passions around Bill Clinton, around Barack Obama. But boy, in some ways, they were nothing compared to what FDR was going through.